Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
Welcome back. Taxation is theft. Of course, you know, as soon as you see my face, I'm going to say that. Welcome back. You may notice we're doing a lot of extra shows this week and last week and next week. Basically, we have a lot of candidates we're trying to get on the show because their elections are coming up at the very beginning of November. So that's why we're doing this so much more than usual. There's a lot of great information to get out to you. Of course, today I have Michael Tolkien, who's the founder of Smart Cities, and we're going to get into that in a minute. And that's a really awesome project that he's working on. Just a quick reminder, if you like this taxation theft hat that I've got on, make sure to go to berman2020.com/merch to get your Berman 2020 official swag. We got all kinds of t-shirts and flyers to help get the message out and everything else. Everything you do there is helping the campaign go. It's helping us to reach more people with this message. It's helping us to run ads. It's helping us to get to conventions and really spread the word. And if you've seen what we're doing, we're really doing a lot. So we can't do it without your help. Of course, if you just want to make a straight up donation, go to berman2020.com/donate. And if you donate $50 or more, we are sending out pins, these really awesome lapel pins that either say taxation is theft or they have the logo with me and the big yellow hat. Anyways, with all that, welcome, Michael Tolkien. How's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So so I saw this. You reached out to me and you sent me this brochure and basically said, check this out. What do you think? And I checked it out and I was like, well, this is really interesting. Now, of course, like my when I first saw it, I was a little bit hesitant because I was like, okay, this sounds like more taxes and central planning. But as I read through it, I realized, hopefully, that this is a little bit more of a voluntary people-controlled system. It's not, let's just put everything in the hands of a few people and let them try to micromanage our lives, which they've been absolutely horrible at. So is that an accurate assessment, or take the floor and just like go crazy and tell us everything about it?
Sure. Well, it's called Smart Cities, and the vision behind it is, what can we do outside of the government, we the people, stepping up with solutions of our own to both address the imminent climate crisis that we're facing, as well as the automation revolution, which is going to wipe out over 90% of the jobs that exist today over a 10-plus year period. So we need to be thinking long term. Our government is incapable of thinking long term. What can we do as citizens? How can we, you know, develop solutions that are not tax based? And I'm with you that, you know, taxation is theft. So how can we also unburden the government with a bunch of the responsibilities it's taken on, like healthcare, for instance, which is a major expense in which their plan is to fund through taxation. And so the result of this exercise of thinking through what we can do as citizens is a plan that rests in the hands of the people, leverages our existing cities, as well as anticipates the creation of new cities, investment in new infrastructure and new programs, and the development of a secondary economy that is owned by the people. So unlike the economy we have today, which is owned by private stakeholders, and either you're working for it or you own a piece of it or both, we are creating a secondary economy where there are no shareholders. The profits are redistributed to the citizens of the United States. And so from that perspective, you are completely correct. We're, you know, this is not central planning 2.0. This is not a government takeover of more of our lives. It's actually the opposite. It's a response to government's failure to provide for the people.
And this is really awesome because, a shameless plug. So I am running for president. And what I try to do with that is not, I mean, I have some, like, I have solutions, but, like, especially when it comes to healthcare, it's not, like, I'm not creating a healthcare system that I'm going to force everybody to participate in. I'm kind of clearing the way to make it possible for all of these other companies, R&D firms, investment firms, and everything else to come back to the marketplace and be able to, you know, create more life-saving medications, to create a pathway for build roads for doctors to be able to come in and become doctors. Because right now you've got, you know, roadblocks every step of the way where government's saying, oh, you want to be a doctor? Well, you know, roadblocks. And of course they tell us it's for our own protection and safety, but it's to limit the supply of doctors so they can jack up the prices, or, you know, whether or not that's their intention, that's what they're doing. And so, like, I see my solution being to kind of clear a pathway to allow that. And it sounds like what you're creating is, like, you're kind of taking on the other end of that role, which is to come up with some of the actual solutions and allow people to jump on board with that to help implement them where it's implemented by the people. And where it goes, nobody knows. But you need a clean pathway in order for people to kind of say, okay, yeah, that's cool, let's jump on board with that.
Exactly. And, you know, we're just taking it one step further and saying, you know what, let's just do it. Let's actually build the program. Let's build our infrastructure projects that will link every major city by high-speed rail, by under 5-hour commute in the contiguous United States. Let's actually design it and develop it, as opposed to leaving it up to the private sector or putting it in the hands of the government. Let's do it through the private sector, but on behalf of the people.
Right. So that's interesting. It becomes like a public, like a truly public. Well, so here's what's interesting about the government. Like, if you look at the way it was created as a Republican form of government, it's really supposed to kind of be like that. Like, people would, like, it's a thing. It's like, that's literally what republic means, a public thing that is a public trust that somehow raises money, supposedly voluntarily, of course that's what it's strayed away from, in order to create these public type things. And that's literally what you're creating, it sounds like, is a public thing that will somehow raise funds through voluntary means and provide things back to the public in the public interest, because that's what it was founded to do. That's what its founding documents will say. Our priority here is to build, you know, to connect cities together in a fast way, and not to extort people along the way. I think it's really awesome. So can we get into, like, what some of these actual solutions are and how you plan to raise the money for them, and how you plan to implement them, or, you know, that sort of thing? How to keep them,
sure,
keep them going.
And it's a series of solutions that have sort of been stitched together, woven together into one comprehensive vision. But for instance, probably the most important innovation in our plan is the funding mechanism. If we're not going to have any sort of tax revenue to subsidize the development or the ongoing operations of these various initiatives, where's the money coming from? And if we don't have private investment, where's the money coming from? So what we decided to do was create a secondary economy where we're generating revenue just like any other company generates revenue. We're going to compete directly with Amazon. We're going to compete directly with Walmart and the automotive companies and the big tech companies and the Facebooks of the world. We're going to compete on behalf of the public with solutions that we know the public wants. And all things being equal, you know, I'll use Facebook as an example. All things being equal, why would you go to Facebook, which is monetizing your data for private interests, versus the public sector version of Facebook that you own a piece of, and that's ultimately going to tie into every other service that is available to you for free? We're not saying that everything's going to be free. I mean, it's going to generate revenue just like, you know, Amazon generates revenue off the sale of goods and services. So too will USA Enterprises generate revenue off of the sale of goods, services, content, and experiences.
Right. So, and this is interesting because I have, like, thoughts going through my head of, you know, how do you get the initial capital to start this? And I'm thinking of things like, you know, there have been programs where, you know, you start with, you start with fresh microcurrencies where, you know, somehow, like I've seen it done on campuses, you know, you contribute to something. And so like it could be, you know, hey, you come to work for us, you help us build the rail and you will be rewarded in this money. But the problem I see with that is, and, you know, I've seen this a lot growing up in Los Angeles where a lot of people are like, yeah, if you work for me on, you know, I'm doing a low budget movie and if you work for me, I'll give you credit, you know, and, you know, things that are, or I'll give you, you know, if you help me build a website, I'll give you stock in the company and all these other things, which turn out to be absolutely worthless. So it's, you know, if you were to start with, you know, rewarding somebody like that, then it, yes, the cost is low, but what's the possibility that you can actually get people to work on something like that versus you have the problem of, you know, how could you get somebody to help to build this rail system if, you know, ultimately, okay, yeah, that sounds fine, but I need Federal Reserve notes because ultimately I need to get home. I need to pay my rent. I need to feed my family. You know, I need to do all these other things, which is, ironically, there are all kinds of reasons that's ironic, but I think these are still some of the same things to compete with. So what about like the initial, you know, how do you get the initial
startup capital?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it's a great point. You know, we're developing a marketplace and an economic engine that will generate revenue on an ongoing basis. The question is, how do we create that engine in the first place? And so to do that, we are creating a proprietary blockchain and cryptocurrency called AmeriCoin. And AmeriCoin will sell savings coins, similar to savings bonds, that will accrue interest and ultimately will be usable within our ecosystem of businesses.
Okay, Yeah, go ahead.
We're creating a currency much like, you know, Bitcoin and other currencies, and we're doing it on behalf of the American people tied to the U.S. dollar.
Right. And that's actually really interesting, too, because, you know, going back to the original foundings of this country, that's, you know, that was kind of the purpose of, you know, I don't want to say U.S. savings bonds, but they, you know, specifically bonds that were for government projects. The government would say, hey, we want to create this project. If you buy these bonds from us so that we can raise the money, then we will pay you back these bonds with interest. And that interest would come from, you know, if they're building a railway somewhere in California, that was one of the projects. They were going to create a bond for a railway that would go from San Francisco to Los Angeles. I don't know if that, I think that bill never passed or something, but that was the thing. They would sell the bonds. People would voluntarily give their money to the government. And in return for that, that rail system would ultimately charge people money just to use. And they would use that money to pay back the bondholders and buy back the bonds, which were paid with interest, which, I mean, that's a completely sound voluntary program, and it doesn't need to be the government who does that program. Of course, whenever we see the government do it, we know that, oh, yeah, well, we're not making enough money because the system is trash because we don't care about customer service. Nobody wants to pay us or use this service. Let's just subsidize it with taxpayers' money, and then the bonds become worthless, and it becomes a money pit, you know, all over again. But that's why we should look at other projects like this that are basically independent of government and rely on, you know, you don't have that backup source of subsidy funding. You have to succeed or you will shut down. And that motivates you to go, of course.
Yeah. And, you know, we're also taking a macro approach, which is unusual for a private sector enterprise to be looking at the economy in its complete sense. But as you talk about, you know, railroads by way of example, we're not thinking about the value creation as purely being mobility. It could be that we offer free mobility to everyone in our new network of high speed rail and transit infrastructure. But we have vested interests in each city in terms of operating businesses and entertainment options and tourism attractions and so on and so forth, that we're able to capture sufficient value to both cover the cost of the infrastructure, the mobility infrastructure that we just talked about, as well as ongoing development of new businesses and new programs. So we're taking a much broader approach to capturing value. And I think that's where the government has been able to play a role that the private sector has, as far as, you know, up to this point, not been able to play, because they have a more comprehensive view of the economy. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, you know, and I'm thinking of all kinds of examples, like an airport, right? You go to an airport and they have all kinds of restaurants and entertainment while you're waiting. And of course, the prices are really high, but they make all that money. And it's because you're kind of stuck there. Now, of course, the flights aren't free. And for some airlines, they maybe discount their tickets so they can upsell you all sorts of other things where they actually make their money. But, you know, that sounds like, you know, I've actually made the proposition for roads, you know, when people are like, oh my God, how are you going to pay for roads? You know, sell advertising space. If the government builds the roads and then says, okay, we're also going to put up the billboards, and then they sell, you know, billboards, or they say, well, since this is our road, you know, we're going to monopolize the gas stations on this road. And of course, you know, somebody else can build another road that's got, so they're still competing against each other, but because they have, they're the ones selling the gas, that's an additional way that they would make money. So you can.
Exactly. And that's a perfect example. Like if one of the gas options, just one, was public owned, that would probably perform better than every other option, because the public will naturally purchase, all things being equal, convenience, accessibility, cost, will purchase from the provider that is serving them, that's creating the roads in this particular instance.
Right. Yeah, so that's really, and it doesn't have to be, you know, one versus the government, one public versus one private. It could just be, you know, two private versus each other, and the same thing would happen. I mean, that's what we see with movie theaters, I guess, would be a good example. I know everybody's all pissed off about that because, but the movie theaters, they charge too much for the movies and too much for a bucket of popcorn. But, you know, yeah, you could eat before you go there, and you don't have to buy their popcorn. That's just, you know, that's, and actually, as a matter of fact, that's a really good correlation there, because from what I understand about the movie theaters is they don't make a dime off of the ticket sales. So they're basically, they have created a free place where they're showing movies for free. They've created the building for free. They've bought the projectors. They paid for everything else, and they're showing movies for free, but they make their money selling expensive popcorn and sodas, and that's how they're able to survive. All of the ticket money goes to the movie companies. So, I think that's actually a really interesting model that correlates pretty well to yours.
Yeah, and I've had a bit of experience actually in the movie cinema industry. And you're right, the majority of the revenue comes from concessions. You know, we may find that in the next generation of entertainment, you're going to see much more systems integration. So by way of example, you know, today you have your Netflix subscription, and you may be able to get a subscription to your local movie theater or to AMC or whatever, but those two things aren't linked. As, you know, entertainment companies begin to think about the user as, you know, one person, as opposed to the cinema goer and then the over the top channel viewer as two different people, when you start to treat your consumer with respect, you say, you know what, let's just do one package, and you get all your movie theater movies and you get all your home movies all under the same fee. The reason that hasn't happened is because you have competing factions, and you have all sorts of, you know, there are regulations in terms of what movie theaters are allowed to do and what the entertainment companies are allowed to do. But if you actually deregulate and allow the private sector to sort of coalesce around the consumer, you'll see better, more valuable services being offered. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, hopefully with the scale of smart cities, we'll be able to do. We'll actually be able to offer you free movie theater access and monetize your consumption elsewhere.
Right. And that's what's really interesting about that is you know, we talk a lot, or we hear other people talking at least about the income gap. And, you know, there are people who have a lot, people who have nothing. If you create a system that's like this, that's, you know, free just to get there, and then, you know, the money is made elsewhere, you actually create a system where somebody who has absolutely nothing can at least, you know, maybe they can't buy the upgrades and, you know, the popcorn and everything, but at least they can get to see the movie. And I think that's a really interesting aspect. But, you know, there's also the question of, you know, the entertainment itself is usually created by, you know, various movie companies. And of course, they want to monopolize and capitalize as much as they possibly can on those films. So how would that kind of play into a system like that? Or is that kind of out of scope?
No. So, you know, our plan is to develop a coalition of enterprises that covers every single area of our economy. So we've thought through, you know, how this all works together, and it will all be part of your USA Go membership. If you have a USA Go membership, you can get over-the-top streaming of content that we produce. So going back to your point about these entertainment companies don't want to give up the value of movie tickets, we will create our own studio with our own directors and our own talent that will create content that's owned by the people and will be distributed in these movie theaters. So at the end of the day, you know, we think about companies as having so much power and control and dominance, but they hire people, they hire individuals, they hire directors, they hire talent. There's nothing that we can't replicate on behalf of the people. I guess that's the underlying point.
All right. Interesting. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So now when you talk about, you're kind of creating a massive conglomerate that produces that's owned by the people and produces stuff for the people. How easy will it be for another equal conglomerate to be formed to compete?
Well, the question is, what is the value proposition or what's the differentiation of this other company to compete? They're also offering free goods and services on behalf of the people. But as a consumer, I would say, well, that already exists. So if we do a bad job collectively, meaning with distributed power, distributed ecosystems and so on and so forth, and we still do a bad job at developing new infrastructure, businesses, enterprises on behalf of the people, then that leaves room for someone to come in and say, well, we're going to do it better. And that's where I think the capitalist free market system is very effective. We're competing in the private sector just like any other company. Our competitive advantage is that we're owned by the public. And I think going forward, you're actually going to see more public companies try to imitate, or I should say private sector companies, try to imitate what we're doing by offering more and more value-added services or benefits to their constituents. So by way of example, Amazon should, if we're successful, should feel pressure that we're taking a huge portion of their market, because the public sector marketplace is going to compete head-to-head with Amazon. Well, in turn, Amazon may say, you know what, we're going to provide, you know, free X, Y, and Z on top of our standard free shipping to entice people to continue to shop with us over the public option. So it has a forcing function in terms of getting the private sector to adapt as well. And the net result of all of this is that consumers are getting a better deal.
Right. Interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah. So this, I mean, you know, it sounds interesting. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be skeptical of, you know, how well it's going to work or how it's going to work. What's your process for, I guess, like, what's it going to take for you to get this thing going? What's the first step? What are you working on? How do you launch this? How do you get it going?
Sure. So the first step is doing exactly this: evangelizing, talking through the elements of our business plan, and seeing where there are holes that we're missing. And so I've been doing that for the past few months, iterating on the white paper. The next step is for us to hire a software team and a blockchain CTO to help us develop the white paper that will ultimately serve as the sales and marketing tool for our initial coin offering, our ICO, where we'll aim to raise around $100 billion in savings coins. So that's the sale of coins that will eventually, one, generate a return, and two, be usable at these public enterprises. So in the coming months, we will we'll be recruiting. And if anyone's interested, would love for them to reach out on Twitter and add their name to our email list.
Awesome. So that's, I mean, it's very ambitious, I would say, to raise $100 billion. I've seen over the past, it's kind of died down a lot lately, but, you know, we saw a lot of ICOs, like, what, about a year ago. That was the big thing. Everyone was selling ICOs raising a lot of money. There were some of them that were topping, you know, $100 million of what they raised. But I think even then, I don't know if a single one of them hit a billion. Now, I guess.
Yeah. And this is, I would sort of, you're correct. These are big numbers and unprecedentedly so. But I think the point of comparison would be Bernie Sanders' $15+ trillion Green New Deal, or some of the other massive investments that, or expenses, frankly, that are being floated around in terms of fighting climate change. So once you put it in that sort of realm, we're talking actually very reasonable investments. And as a point of comparison, second point of comparison, we raised about $2 trillion in today's dollar terms of savings bonds to fund the World War II effort. I view what we're doing as being comparable in terms of its significance. We need to upgrade our infrastructure, and we need to very quickly modernize in advance of this automation revolution that's going to happen whether we like it or not. The private sector is moving forward with automating away jobs, and that should be a good thing. That should be a great thing for our country, but we need the infrastructure to support it.
Right. Yeah, and I've been listening to a lot about what, you know, Andrew Yang is talking about and the reality of automation and what that's going to do. And I think, you know, you're right. It is a good thing. We shouldn't be fighting it. We shouldn't be, you know, forcing ourselves to do remedial jobs just to keep, you know, just to keep the unemployment down. Because ultimately all that automation reduces the cost of things, which, you know, basically makes them closer to free. And you know, I think a lot of that is, you know, it's really going to be amazing technology that, you know, helps make society much better overall. So I think that is something that we should absolutely welcome. I'm curious as so you know, I've been involved in startups before, and I'm an entrepreneur myself, and I'm always looking at, like, okay, but what is kind of your minimum viable product? Like, what's the least amount that you could, you know, because, as you know, as a new business raising capital to start something, somebody might say, okay, well, look, we don't know who you are, we don't know how this is going to operate, this is a big experiment. Like, you've compared it to World War II, where we've raised, you know, trillions of dollars to go to war, but that was the U.S. government that everybody knew and had, everybody alive during World War II had been, you know, living with the federal government in their backyard for their entire lives at that point. So they knew them, they knew who they were, and, you know, they shouldn't have trusted them, but they did trust them. You know, everybody just blindly trusts government. What's, you know, it seems like if you're going to start something huge like this, you need to start maybe with a minimum viable product to kind of grow that trust and show that you have a proof of concept and that it's working, and grow from there. Are you planning to do anything like that?
Well, we are taking that exact same approach. Our MVP is the $100 billion investment in a series of, you know, again, compared to a $15 trillion Green New Deal. We have the same objectives, and we're trying to do really big things here, change the course of climate change. What we're doing is scaling that down to a small enough amount that we know we can raise and will allow us to fund a social network, will allow us to fund a media platform, will allow us to fund some of the smaller, more bite-sized elements of our platform. And then we can, you know, talk about the $25 trillion infrastructure project to connect all cities by high-speed transit by 2030. Like that piece of it, so it's all relative. The $100 billion is the MVP relative to a $25 trillion plan. I think you would push back and say, well, can't you just go smaller? Can't you just do like the $1 million MVP and prove that a company of the people is actually effective? The challenge is this requires a critical mass. I mean, we're basically trying to create an enterprise that's comparable to the size of the U.S. government in terms of the people it services and the jobs it creates and so on and so forth. And so it does require a certain critical mass of people across the country to buy into it. And our competitive advantage, remember, is the fact that the public already owns these. There's no like granting in the future. The public owns these companies on day one. So everyone has a vested interest in making this work. And either we philosophically believe in collaboration as a country and we say, you know what, capitalism was good for what it was, you know, cultivated competition, and that competition yielded innovation in a variety of different ways. But now we need to come together and roll up our sleeves and work alongside one another to develop something greater than any one of us can create on our own. Either we believe in that fundamentally, or we just don't believe in that ethos. And I think that's more the challenge right now, is to break down the skepticism driven by or driven from years, decades of false promises and empty hopes.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, you know, I, you know, for one thing, I know this is going to be a hard sell just because what I'm doing with my campaign is a hard sell. You know, people are skeptical.
But how do you get, can I ask you a question? How do you get to zero taxes without another form of revenue?
Right. So the way I see it is we take the existing systems that we have and we simply, you know, first we get rid of the wasteful ones, and the ones that are operating with some sort of a user cost would continue to do so. So like, for example, you know, everybody wants courts. Well, courts charge fees whenever you want to file a lawsuit. They charge penalties for, you know, if you're convicted of a crime to raise the money to cover the cost of the court. If you know, those don't need to be subsidized by taxes. Then you have the Department of Education, which, you know, the federal Department of Education is just a money pit that money goes into and never comes out of. So, but of course, at the local level, you are paying taxes for those schools. And I would say, you know, we can easily replace that with, you know, much lower cost education through technology and homeschooling and unschooling and internet. And you know, you can download an entire book for free in a matter of seconds compared to paying, you know, $500 per textbook for, you know, a 5-year-old, which is insane. So I think if we get rid of all those wastes, then we would be able to drive those taxes down, and people would still be paying for, you know, some services, but they'd be paying much, much, much less.
Got it.
So I think there's, when you look at it that way, like I see that as like a transitional thing, right? It's not like we just walk in and say, okay, we're going to flip everything over and start, you know, revising everything on day one. It's a transition that everyone can transition to, but it's, you know, in terms of deregulating, you create opportunities where somebody can, you know, if we deregulate the medical industry, we create opportunities where doctors or drug companies can come in and say, hey, I have this great idea. I think I can produce this new drug. And you allow it to be created. So you're not paying for it to be created. You're just allowing other people to do it. So, but what it sounds like with your system, where the skepticism would come from is just, okay, you want to raise all of this money, and you want to create this massive, massive infrastructure from, you know, from zero to 100 billion. And what knowledge do we have that any of it will work, or, you know, that you're going to be able to deliver, or, you know, any of that, all these other questions that come up when, you know, let's say you're just trying to fund a regular business, or, you know, even when the government tries to do it, when the government tried to raise, you know, that I don't know how many billions of dollars it was for that California railway, most of the people said no to it, because even though they'd be selling bonds and it would not be a net loss, it was people didn't want to buy the bonds, and people didn't trust the government to be able to complete such a system when, you know, especially because, I mean, California had a bad track record on top of, you know, just failed projects, you know, on top of their established, you know, everyone knowing who they are. So I think even then there's some skepticism to invest in those really large projects if there's uncertainty as to whether or not it can succeed.
I agree with you. I think that what we're creating is a vehicle. And so when you talk about, well, why should we trust this Smart Cities Confederation of Enterprises? It's because the people own it. And not a dollar will be spent without the board being elected by the people. And so from that standpoint, it's if you are elected, if popular vote selects, I'm going to make up a number, 10 board members, those 10 board members should inspire the confidence required to get us from to one, raise the money, and to two, execute on the plan and deliver the goods and services that we anticipate building out. And again, none of what we're doing is super complicated. Like, if I told you I'm going to create an Amazon competitor, you would say, okay, how are you going to get the money to do it? But you wouldn't really question whether or not it can be done. With enough money, right, you can hire the right engineers, you can build the fulfillment centers, you can develop the robotics. Like, it's all very doable. It's just a question of having sufficient capital to do it. And that, going back to my earlier point, $100 billion is like the lowest amount that sort of gives this thing enough cushion that you can really build out the appropriate infrastructure to compete effectively and not have something that sort of languishes. If it's too small, it'll die. They're just such well-entrenched interests that would not want to see a public sector, a public option, if you will, a public option for everything take off. Amazon being, you know, at the top of that list, you know, good for them that they've created a business that has been so valuable and so powerful. But at the end of the day, they are, if they're going to be checked, they're going to do everything in their power, lobby and whatever else they need to do to shut it down.
Right. Well, so okay, let me go back to something that you said in the beginning of this, which is a little concerning. Just because, I mean, I look at the political system we have now, and, you know, it's that same kind of thing. There's a popular vote for Congress, and, you know, everybody's voting, and ultimately we have a Congress who really doesn't care about us, because compared to the population who votes for them, they're very, very few. They don't really represent...
Wait, you said we have a popular vote in Congress?
Yeah, well, to elect our congressman.
In the House.
Right. Yeah, in the House.
The Senate's not a popular vote.
Right, right. But so the same point is that if you ask people, you know, Congress has a very, very low, you know, when people are polled on whether they trust Congress, whether they think they're doing a good job, the rating is always really, really low. And it's what's fascinating about this, and I talk about this all the time, is, you know, everybody always says, like, oh, yeah, Congress is so terrible. They do a terrible job. Why is that? And then they go out and they vote for the same person that they voted for last time. And they do this because they think it's not my congressman who's terrible. It's everybody else's congressman. Because ultimately, we all have different wants, and we're never going to be able to agree on certain things. Somebody's going to come along and say, well, I think this entire system should be run completely different. And they're going to feel that way. And people are going to be butting heads over that. And then you're also going to have people who are, they create like their own little faction of saying like, yeah, you know, we could really profit from this. We could, if we get our people on that board, we can sway the votes to change the system, to do a little bit of something this way so that we're able to profit and we get to live on yachts, you know, and big mansions and everything else. What kind of checks would you have to prevent that from sort of happening with a board of, you know, let's say it's not even 10, let's just say it's 100 or 1,000 members?
It's a great question. And these are the kinds of conversations that are ongoing. So I don't want to sort of, you know, put a line in the sand and say, this is the way it's got to be. I think that for the purpose of overseeing, basically we have to look at the structure and the function of the board. And the board in our case is designed just like any other private company's board or company's board is designed to identify and appoint key hires. So each of the enterprises will have a CEO, and that board will be responsible for selecting the CEOs. That's their primary function, as well as overseeing budget and the long-term strategic vision across the Confederation. So, you know, if we're collectively voting these people to select individual CEOs and they are corrupted in some way, that should be very public in a way that we are able to self-correct it. Remember, just like any other company, we can hire and fire at will. So it's not like we have terms. There are no terms. You know, we hire someone, maybe we give them a 10-year term, but we can cut it off for bad performance, hire someone new. So there should be that ongoing feedback mechanism that allows us to make us being the people to maintain control of enterprises. The other thing, going to back to the discussion about Congress, that I think is important to mention, I think there's a structural issue there as well, where we have individuals elected to essentially govern across every single issue you can imagine, even though they don't have a background across every issue. You can't possibly. Right. So I think we need to see a diverse, like my preference would be if we were rewriting the Constitution, and something I think we should very much be looking at doing in honor of our nation's 250th anniversary in 2026, redrafting the Constitution, which is a fundamentally racist, sexist document. If we were going to rewrite it, I would say, well, why do we have two representatives for each state? One, we should have cities representing themselves. Cities can operate independent of their states. And so I'd like to propose bringing back the city state. And two, we should have issues-based representatives elected into office. So, you know, if you are hiring someone to help develop the technology policy, public policy around technology issues, those people should come from the tech sector. They should campaign as being from the tech sector, but they aren't necessarily the same people to weigh in on healthcare policy and public health policy. So I think we need to structurally re-engineer systems to get the outcome that we're looking for. And this is just one proposal, going back to smart cities, just one proposal to do that.
Interesting. That's a lot of interesting information to consume. I've never heard plans like that. So that's something I want to think about and see, because, you know, you're right. We, especially when we look at Congress, it's all mostly lawyers, right? And lawyers are the worst when it comes to writing laws, because they write the crap in legalese and nobody can understand it, and we're expected to obey all of it, which is the worst. But, you know, I think you're right. When it comes to medicine, we should have doctors. On the flip side, I think at the same time, you have you know, let's say, for example, the tobacco industry. If tobacco, let's say, were one of those issues, you could have the tobacco industry come in and say, well, we're going to ban vapes because, you know, we think those are dangerous for your health, even though they're selling, you know, cigarettes. But that's because that's already the established economy in cigarettes. They already have those billions of dollars. They're able to lobby and get their people elected. So I think that, I don't know, that's an interesting proposition. But I think it's one of those things where it could go either way. But going back to your concept of like the big, so you have your board of 10 who elects like a CEO for each one of these kind of, sectors of this company. I'm curious on why wouldn't you have, like, instead of people voting for the 10 people and letting those 10 people pick or hire the, you know, the CEOs for each section or each department, why wouldn't you allow the people to vote for boards independently for each one of these departments so that they're completely isolated? Like, so here's an example that I use with the government shutdown, right? When the government shut down, because it was one organization that controls everything, everything shut down, right? The parks shut down, TSA shut, or well, TSA didn't shut down, but they weren't getting paid. The military, you know, everybody else, all these, the Department of Education, everything shut down. But if they each had their own bank accounts and they each had their own revenue streams, then if, you know, let's say the Department of Education couldn't balance their budget and so therefore they had to shut down, the parks would still be open, TSA would still be open, the police and the, you know, fire departments, they'd all still be
totally open. So it's a great question. And where I net out on it is, one, it's really hard to get people to vote and to pay attention. Mm-hmm. And so as much as possible, want to consolidate that into like even 10 roles is a lot, even though that wouldn't be on wouldn't all be hired on or elected at the same time. That's still a lot of roles to fill and for the public to be conscious of. So that's the first piece of it, is just getting the popular vote. It requires a critical mass of people pay attention. And the second is that we actually want all of our enterprises to be focused on you as a user. We want everyone sharing the, not necessarily, how do I say this? We don't necessarily want there to be competition for revenue by way of example, where USA Works, which is the infrastructure and transportation arm, says, oh, well, we need to monetize because we need revenue, even though what may end up making more sense is to not monetize the transportation and to just have USA Studios, USA Labs, which are the product development arms, or USA Markets, which will sell goods and services, that you know, we monetize there, and that covers the cost of the infrastructure. So that's a very long, convoluted way of saying we want everyone aligned around the consumer, around the user. And I think if you have separate boards with separate incentive structures, you may end up creating competition unintentionally.
Interesting. So let me ask this then. If you have, okay, so let's say, for example, these 10 people, you know, just kind of like how we were talking about how, you know, somebody with one specialization, like if you're a lawyer, you shouldn't decide policy on tech, or doctors, a doctor shouldn't decide policy on tech. This group of 10 people might be overseeing, you know, so many different aspects of this thing that, you know, you've got so many projects, so many different projects, that they're probably not going to have direct oversight into each of them, right?
So their role is to hire the CEO, but not to play a role in day-to-day activities. So right. These are people that would sort of be, I mean, I shouldn't mention names, but people who are very well recognized in the private sector today for their business acumen are the same people who should be on this board. Okay. And so then, they should have a track record of having created massive enterprises in the private sector.
Okay, so now let's say they're overseeing the Works project. normally in this case, what you would do, like, let's say you have some big conglomerate like Google, and you have your board, and they oversee, you know, they have all their different projects, and they look at one project and they say, okay, we put, you know, one person in charge of this project. It's like the CEO of that project. They look at that project and they give them metrics, right? They say, like, okay, did you increase revenue this month? Did you know that kind of stuff? Did you increase the number of users? Did you, all this? What kind of metrics and goals and incentives would you be giving to each of these departments to make sure that, you know, to be able to tell that the CEOs of each project is doing what they're supposed to be doing to kind of, you know, track their progress or make sure they're being successful at what they're doing?
Totally. Well, given that the people own this set of companies, we can be transparent. So we will have a dashboard that ultimately rolls up to the board level into short-term and long-term objectives. And that's really important because, unlike other aspects of the public sector, which focus on the short-term, we actually want to cultivate, craft, and implement a 25, 50-year vision, so that we're kind of, and that's always going to be in a state of becoming, so that we're always pushing the envelope further ahead, and not just planning for tomorrow. So there will be a set of short-term and long-term goals across the Confederation, and then within each business, they'll have their own objectives. All of this will be codified and will be available in a dashboard. So you'll actually be able to, as a U.S. resident, go on to the website and see what our sales are for USA market, and see, you know, which items are trending, and to do so without breaking any sort of law, because the information is owned by the people.
Interesting.
Okay. So we're taking a different approach. Most companies would be very secretive about their data, right, and would view it as competitive intelligence. In our case, we view the public sharing of information as being a competitive advantage. It just builds a stronger relationship with our constituents.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. And I mean, like, there's still like a hesitation in me that sounds like, okay, but this sounds like what some socialist would come up with. But at the same time, I know that you're saying, like, yeah, but it's a voluntary program. So anyone who doesn't want to participate in it doesn't have to participate in it, right?
And what's critical, you know, we're not saying we want to take over the private sector. We're saying we want to compete, and we want to compete hardcore. But we still want there to be a private sector, because otherwise you run into the same sort of problems and the diminishing services and so on and so forth. It's really important that there is an alternative always to keep us honest. And if we don't do a good job, then there will be someone else in the private sector who's going to come up with the same model but do it better. You know what I mean?
Right. Now, this is interesting, because, like, okay, I've always thought that, you know, when I was a kid, I always kind of wanted to be an inventor, and I would hear about, like, you know, these science fairs and everything, that, you know, the World Fair and all this stuff, and people would go and show off their inventions, and they'd get, you know, government money to, you know, just for doing something. And I always kind of thought, this was back when I was a little socialist kid, you know, just print the money and take care of all the problems. I always thought that was really great, because that incentivizes people to do good. And so I'm wondering if there's room in your program for something like that, where if somebody says, hey, look, I see what you guys are doing, I came up, like, I have no involvement in it, I do my own thing during the day, but I see what you're doing and I'm interested in it, and because I have a little bit of expertise in some area of some project that you're working on, I've come up with a new way that I want you guys to implement. Would there be space for somebody to basically say, I'm going to, you know, create whatever proof of concept of this new idea, take it to, you know, somebody in this organization and say, hey, if you do this, you'll save lots of time and money, you'll do things more efficiently, whatever, you'll make people happier, and then create some sort of reward, almost like, you know, in the private sector world, that would be, I started a new business, it does this really cool thing, I'll sell you the technology or the IP.
You kind of hit it on the head, in terms of, not just, yeah, the answer to your question is yes, of course, but on top of that, that really is the core employee that we're looking for. Every single person who joins our organization is going to have that mindset. Like, hey, I have a way to do it better, or I want to get a job and I want to do something really great. I mean, we're not hiring just anyone. We're hiring the best and the brightest, and the best and the brightest are people that really want to see their creations made. They want to see, you know, they want to change the world. It's this artificial incentive structure that's been, you know, hammered into us from the moment that we are in grade school, that it's about how much you make. Like, oh, you got to make more money. Most people, most engineers are not motivated by money. Most creatives are not motivated by money. They just want their movie to get made. And right. So from that perspective, yes, we're looking for those kinds of people to come and join us and add value on behalf of the public. And it creates that added benefit. Anyone who's ever dreamt of creating something huge and changing the world, now you have a platform to do it. We're not a company that's driven by the bottom line. We're a company that's driven by creating value.
Interesting. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, these are all some really great thoughts. And I wish you the best with this. I really would like to see, you know, something come out of it. I know with any business you start it and sometimes it comes out completely different than you planned, but it comes out to something, and that's really awesome. So it's good to see that you've got, you know, so many ideas going into this and I'd really like to see where it goes. Where can somebody, if somebody wants to learn more about this project, where can they go?
Currently to Twitter @SmartCitiesUS.
Okay. And is there, you sent me like a white paper before. Is that good for anyone to download or?
Absolutely. Share that broadly. We'll continue to update at the same link as we get more feedback and iterate on ideas. But by all means, feel free to share.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Is there anything you want to say before we go? Anything else you want to plug?
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. And again, if others have thoughts and ideas, we are looking to strengthen the document and add as many perspectives as possible. So feel free to reach out.
Awesome. Sounds great. So the Twitter again is @SmartCitiesUS. Go check it out. Thank you, Michael Tolkien, for joining us. This was definitely some really interesting stuff that we haven't heard before. And it's always great to hear new ideas, open your mind, expose to new things, think about things that, you know, hey, you never thought of before. Will they work? Who knows? Let's sometimes you just got to try them out. So it's great to hear that. Thank you again for coming on the show. We'll keep an eye on your project and see how it goes. And taxation is theft.
Thank you very much.
All right. I'll see you around.
Take care.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
Rhodes.
You boys like Mexico?